Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Please keep eating with such a big group. We know we like to start before everybody's necessarily finished their meal, but it takes us a little long with so many people. This is a sold-out event, which tells you how many people have an interest in Tim's speech. So please do keep eating. A couple of housekeeping notes as you finish your meals. First of all, please, everybody, turn off your cell phones now, or at the very least, silence them. We do now put these presentations up on the internet, on our website, and it really disrupts it if video, if you've got somebody's beep, 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 right as somebody says something particularly interesting. So please do turn them off now. Second of all, I'd like to mention our upcoming events. Those of you who were signed up should know, our event actually tomorrow was canceled. We had a speaker on Chinese soft power, and for medical reasons, he canceled last week, and we've tried to reach all of you that tomorrow's lunch is not on. Then on next week, on the 17th, we have John Warham, one of the Cathay pilots who lost their jobs in the strike a few years ago. That event is sold out, although I believe we do have a waiting list. With that, I'd like to introduce our speaker today. Many of you may know Tim. He has a long-standing connection to Hong Kong. He started his journalistic career here from 1973 to 1980, working for the Star and other organizations. His wife has a connection. She's here, Allison, and on behalf of the club, I'd like to welcome her. She is the daughter of one of the British officers on the group. We also have, and I'd like to welcome them also on behalf of the club, we have Donald, the son of Admiral Chan here, the title subject of the book. We also have Sheena, daughter of another of the British officers, and her son Tom. So we have a grandson as well here from the party that escaped from Hong Kong. This book has, I think, attracted a lot of interest right now. This is, after all, the 70th anniversary of the escape from Hong Kong, of the fall of Hong Kong in 1941. The book was timed for that. It's a coincidence that it's coming out as there's a movie coming out about Nanjing in China. We have a lot of interest in this, and we're so glad that all of you came. Here's Tim Luard. Thank you.
I seem to recall that visiting speakers here started off their addresses by saying how thrilled and happy they were to be at this famous club in this wonderful city. However, in my case, it's true. I really do feel that Hong Kong is my favorite place in the world, and the FCC is high up on my list of favorite places in Hong Kong. So I am very honored to have been asked to speak here. Well, I wasn't actually asked, I asked myself, but the committee kindly accepted me. And I really do feel thrilled and excited and happy to be here, so much so that I'll probably be lost for words. So I'm going to equip myself with some notes and just check that I can show some pictures. But it's a book. Oh, no, it's gone. Right, it's going to be a delicate operation. But the 7 years... Sorry. Sorry about this. Right, good luck. The 7 years I spent in Hong Kong in the 1970s, starting out as a reporter and living out on Cheung Chau, were without doubt the best years of my life so far. While I was still a student at Edinburgh in 1973, I'd written to Tony Lawrence here, care of the FCC. He had already been a famous correspondent for many years, but his reply was very warm and positive. He hasn't changed, I'm glad to note. So I duly headed east to learn how to be a journalist, though I did take 6 months getting here along the Asian hippie trail. Soon after I arrived, I went to see the fearsomely gruff and grisly editor of the English tabloid, The Star, a certain Graham Jenkins of pre-war Shanghai fame. And he sent me down to the FCC in Sutherland House, as it was then, to see the equally gruff and grisly but much larger figure of Dick Hughes, who was hunched over the bar talking to one Kevin Sinclair, who I seem to remember had just had an operation and was smoking a cigarette through a hole in his throat. But between the three of them, they came up with my first lesson in journalism in a triple Australian accident that I can't even begin to replicate. Buy yourself a suit and get yourself a bloody haircut. So my Jimi Hendrix hairdo was lost for the sake of a job on The Star, helping to write the Dear Pansy column. And here I am after many years at the BBC, complete with suit and John Major hairdo, back at the FCC, now trying to learn how to be not just a journalist, but an author. The Sino-British escape from Hong Kong, which began just an hour after the colony surrendered 70 years ago, is one of the epic untold tales of the Second World War. I'm not going to tell the story here, as that might spoil your enjoyment of the book, but suffice it to say, it lives up to the best traditions of Hollywood, with car chases, speeding torpedo boats, men diving overboard in a hail of bullets, night marches across paddy fields and rivers and mountains, dodging enemy cavalry patrols, sleeping under the stars, the sort of adventure you just couldn't hope to get these days, which is perhaps why I've spent the past few years researching it and trying to recreate it. But one of the most appealing things for me about the Great Escape of Christmas Day 1941, through the various Japanese rings of encirclement in Hong Kong and occupied China, is the rich array of characters it threw together. From a tiny, twinkly-eyed Chinese admiral with one leg, sitting in the middle there, to a huge, drunken chief petty officer from Plymouth, one of the rabble at the back, with a lopsided cap. A New Zealand sheep farmer, a Nottingham pig slaughterer, a senior colonial civil servant, a secret agent or two, an old school Indian Army cavalry officer, all united by the goal of reaching freedom on the most tragic day in Hong Kong's history. This is a photo of the 68 men who made it through to the nearest nationalist Chinese army base at Huizhou, or Huaichao as they called it, in Guangdong, some 70 miles inland from Mers Bay. It was taken by a local photographer with his last plate. And don't worry, I'm not going to try and take you through all 68 of them, but I'd like to introduce at least some of the leading figures and explain how they came to be part of this bizarre group that was lucky enough to end up evading capture and long years of internment. Chan Chak, or Chen Se in Putonghua, was born in Hainan, went to naval school in Canton, and as a teenager took an active role in the Republican Revolution of 1911. He became close to Sun Yat-sen and was later head of the Guangdong Fleet and southern president of the ruling Kuomintang, KMT. But he was in effect a sort of warlord battling it out with all the others in the chaos of China in the mid-20s and 30s. Here he is in Nanjing in 1935 with his family, like his children, several of whom came with us when we reenacted the journey to Huaichao 2 years ago. Chan Chak was wonderfully charismatic and charmed everyone, a bit like his son Donald, who's here. But he was also tough, as is Donald. You crossed Chan Chak at your peril. His left leg was amputated in 1939 after an injury during the Japanese blockade of Canton. Chan became China's chief representative in Hong Kong a couple of years before Pearl Harbor and the attack on the British colony. It was a period when Hong Kong was brimming with gangsters and intrigue, and much of what he did was highly secretive as head of the KMT underground, since China's ruling party was still banned here. Chan's immediate Chinese colleagues in Hong Kong who were to accompany him on the escape were Colonel SKE, who's second from left in this shady-looking group that includes some British as well as Chinese spies in China's wartime capital, Chongqing. SK was Chan Chak's intelligence chief and number two to the admiral on Japan's blacklist. He was an accomplished calligrapher, but was also not averse to executing his rivals in cold blood. Henry Hsu was Chan's aide-de-camp, dynamic and clean-cut fellow. He was known to all as Henry. He died in 2009, age 96, the last survivor of our group, as far as we know. At 6'3", well over a foot taller than his boss, he was a champion athlete and swimmer. He was later on the International Olympic Committee and a leading hotel owner and MP in Taiwan. And there was Yeung Chun, seen here later with his family. He was a rickshaw puller in Canton before Chan Chak took him on as a bodyguard. He practiced martial arts, carried a revolver, as did most people on the escape, and was a general factotum to the admiral, even carrying him on his back at times. In Hong Kong's Central District, looking down Pedder Street from Queens Road towards Devo Road, was Shell House, where Chan Chak and his team were based on the second floor, posing as a trading firm. After the battle began on December the 8th, 1941, they formed what amounted to a shadow administration, helping to keep Hong Kong's Chinese population calm and loyal to the British. Henry drove around town buying off triads to stop them taking Japanese money to rise up against their colonial rulers. Chan Chak himself was in the thick of the action and was said to have been involved in several shootouts with fifth columnists, including one group whom he ambushed in a cinema in Weston, killing many of them. On another occasion, Chan grabbed a few grenades, raced off up to the mid-levels, and hurled them down the hill to blow up an agent who had been sending signals to Japanese gunners across the harbor. But he was also busy liaising with Chongqing and with Hong Kong's senior officials, including David McDougall, 37-year-old head of the Ministry of Information. With his piercing blue eyes and soft Scottish accent, David McDougall had come out to join the colonial service at the age of 24. He'd been sent to Canton to learn Chinese, and that's where he got to know Chan Chak. They played tennis and became firm friends at a time when there was very little mixing of any kind between British and Chinese. It's probably why Sheena and Donald aren't sitting next to each other right now, but separated by my wife. McDougall soon became known as a friend of China generally. On the one hand, he was frustrated by die-hard British attitudes towards the local population. He would later be one of the great reforming colonial secretaries. On the other, he was determined to stand up to Japan, unlike the British government. Japanese troops already occupied much of China, of course. McDougall made some unprecedented visits to Chongqing for talks with Chinese leaders. He met both Chiang Kai-shek and Zhou Enlai. David McDougall later spelt out his reasons for joining the escape party. I had good reason to know I had been marked down by the Japanese as pro-Chongqing, which I was, and as a center of undercover anti-Japanese intrigue, which I was not. For these and other reasons, I decided that the risks of attempting to break out of Hong Kong after its fall would be preferable to falling into Japanese hands as a supposed secret agent in possession of information I did not in fact have. McDougall asked the governor if it would be permissible to try to escape once the inevitable Japanese victory occurred, and on learning there was no official objection, he and his chief assistant, a dashing young Canadian called Ted Ross, began making their own plans. Before the war, Ross had gone out on weekends to the islands with his canoe. One plan he and Mac discussed was to escape in the canoe. They would cross to the mainland and somehow pass through the Japanese positions to guerrilla country beyond. They prepared packs with spare underwear, chocolate, and medicines. But as Hong Kong grimly held on, they still had a vital job to do. When the Japanese attacks began, the information ministry had been based in the Hong Kong Bank building, seen here behind the Supreme Court. 3 times a day, Ted or David would make their way up past the French mission, across Garden Road to the military HQ. They'd get a briefing and return to write up bulletins for the press, masterpieces of bad news dressed up as good. It was a perilous journey. There was almost constant shelling from Kowloon plus bombing from the air. This photo shows the Supreme Court guarded by sandbags, and the bank, which you can just see peeping up behind, was itself coming under heavy fire. So after a few days, Mac and Ross moved offices to the more sheltered Gloucester Hotel in Pedder Street. This was also handy for keeping in touch with Chan Chak. Since he was playing such a heroic role, the Hong Kong authorities thought they should at least do something to help him get out once the fighting was over. McDougall promised to let Chan know the moment the governor decided to surrender. Secret plans for his escape, he assured him, were in hand. The British also felt that several of their own senior military men needed to be got out when the time came. People such as intelligence officers who were carrying sensitive information. Now, the Royal Air Force didn't have any planes left after that first day of Japanese raids, but they did have their own intelligence officer, Max Oxford. He had originally come to Hong Kong to help run the airport. He was a great friend of the celebrated American writer Emily Hahn and her lover, Major Charles Boxer. Oxford was known for giving wild parties. After the Japanese took Kowloon, however, he based himself in the battle box, the underground warren that formed the General's HQ in Victoria Barracks, where the Shangri-La Hotel now is. With him down in the battle box were various others who would end up on the escape party, among them Captain Freddie Guest. He had been a cavalryman on the Northwest frontier. He had played polo for England and football for Chelsea as an amateur. He saw himself as a good old-fashioned boy's own hero. He was on the general staff, as was Captain Peter McMillan, a good chum of Freddie's, who Guest describes in the book he wrote about his escape after the war. Peter was a young man, an old Etonian, and son of a bishop. Robust, red-faced, and clean-shaven, he looked more like a bishop than an army officer. Despite that, Guest insists in his highly dramatized account that the two of them led all the most daring operations during the escape, something that was never corroborated by any of their 66 companions, some of whom were extremely rude about his book. Major Arthur Goring, our third staff officer, appears in the escape photos in cap, scarf, and white sweater, with pistol in a low-hanging belt around ample stomach. He was a senior figure in the Indian Army, a witty confirmed bachelor, and a friend of Bill Robinson of Indian Police Intelligence. They're both in this photo on either side of a missionary's wife who welcomed them all in Kukong or Shaoguan. Bill's just behind her with the white cravat. Both he and Goring had been sent for from India to deal with a threatened Sikh mutiny in Hong Kong's police and armed forces. They found themselves trapped here by the Japanese invasion. There was a big map of the region on the wall of the operations room in the battle box, and Goring said he used to gaze at it as reports came in of the fighting around him, plotting how he could get back to his beloved India when the end came. It was a long way, of course, across China via the barely passable Burma Road. This turned out to be the route home taken by the British escape party. But the most immediate problem was that the coastal strip nearest Hong Kong was already occupied by the Japanese. As enemy troops swarmed over Hong Kong, an escape plan began to take shape. The man behind it was F.W. Kendall, a tough, no-nonsense Canadian known to all as Mike. Some also called him the Canadian Bison. He commanded a small group called Z-Force, which came under the newly formed Special Operations Executive, or SOE, and had been stocking arms in some caves near the Chinese border in preparation for working behind enemy lines. Kendall and his Z-Force colleague, Colin McEwen, my father-in-law, who had come to Hong Kong a few years previously as a physical education and Latin teacher, saw the Japanese coming over the border on the first day of Hong Kong's war from one of these caves high up on Tai Mo Shan. These two then had to leave the rest of the group there and slip back to HQ to report details of this quicker-than-expected Japanese advance. And together with a third member of the commando group, Monia Talon, a Jewish white Russian travel agent come machine gun expert from Shanghai, seen later in retirement in Australia, Kendall and McEwen spent the rest of the battle working with Chan Chak and SK in eliminating fifth columnists. On December the 21st, the three SOE men went out to Aberdeen. They were looking for a boat that they could use to ship guns to Chinese guerrillas who might then attack the Japanese from the rear in the new territories. Aberdeen's fishing population had been moved aside at the start of the battle to make room for the Royal Navy, which had its base there, or what few vessels it had. Almost the only ones left by this stage were the five remaining boats of the motor torpedo boat flotilla. The MTBs, being small and fast, were just what was needed to link up with the guerrillas. But with Hong Kong's surrender looking ever more imminent, it soon became clear that the MTBs were also just what was needed for the actual escape plan. Each of the five boats in the flotilla had two officers, mainly from the local Naval Volunteer Force, the HKRNVR, or Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, and a crew of seven or eight Royal Navy ratings. So this would mean the escape party became a lot bigger than it had originally been planned. The torpedo boats didn't have the fuel capacity to go much further than about 50 miles up the Chinese coast. So the crews would have to leave their boats behind on some remote beach, hiding them from Japanese eyes, and join Chan Chak and the others as they struck out overland towards Free China. I don't have time to pick out many individuals from the large British naval contingent in the escape party, but suffice to say it included some colorful characters. Commander Hugh Montague had been brought back from retirement on his New Zealand farm to be senior officer at the Aberdeen Naval Base. He was soon struggling to keep discipline among some of the sailors who weren't too keen on the idea of marching across China. One of those whose feet were giving him hell and was particularly fond of the rum the Navy carried with them at all times was this man, Chief Petty Officer Gilbert Thumbs, who was the former butcher's boy from Nottingham. The flotilla commander, Horace Gandhi, was another who was a bit taken aback by the idea of operating on land with a lot of Chinese guerrillas. He was a First World War veteran who had been a naval cadet with the Prince Royal in 1910. But somehow, bonds were forged across the racial, class, and other divides in this marvelously motley escape party, as we can see in this picture of one of the Chinese guerrillas with two of the Royal Navy sailors. Exactly 100 years after the First Opium War and the ceding of Hong Kong, the escape was hailed as an unprecedented example of Sino-British cooperation. Chan Chak was granted a British knighthood, and his friend David McDougall later received one of China's top medals, the Order of the Brilliant Star. As I say, for the full story, the first time it's been told in full, you'll have to read the book. I hope I've at least whetted your appetite for finding out how these various characters ended up getting on with each other. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. That was fascinating. And with that, I'd like to throw open the floor for questions. Who would like to ask the first question? Please identify yourselves when you do so. Well, before somebody asks them what you think of your questions, why don't I just ask a question? Actually, if anybody here in the audience knows, we were just having the conversation at the, before the lunch began. We have a photo downstairs of Mao and Chiang Kai-shek toasting each other at the FCC when we were still in Chongqing, right at the end of World War II. Does anybody here know if Mao and Chiang Kai-shek met on any other occasion? They did not meet during the Xi'an incident. Does anybody else know? I thought this might be a group that would have some people who love Hong Kong history. No? Okay. Well, let me throw open the floor again for questions. Right here in the front, please. Can we wait just a moment for the microphone to come?
I'm not here in a work capacity. I just wanted to come because it just sounded like a lot of fun and a lot of interesting history, which it has been. I'm curious as to where did you find yourself, what archives did you find yourself mostly in? Was it easy to get access to them? Were there any Chinese archives that you looked at and got translated? Tell us a little bit about the research process, if you don't mind.
Well, I started off with Alison's father's diary, and we got that published and found links through a website that had been set up by the son of one of the Stokers, Richard Hyde, to other family members, such as Donald Chan. And a surprising number of them had diaries, especially some of the motor torpedo boat captains. So first it was a matter of meeting all the original party had gone, but meeting their descendants and talking to them, getting anecdotes and letters and diaries. I then went to three places in London where I live, the National Archives, where there were a lot of documents such as David McDougall's letters to the Colonial Office, to the Imperial War Museum, where those diaries, which had been actually lodged by families such as Gandhi's, were housed in big boxes with all sorts of notes about the escape. And the British Library, where I did a lot of research with old maps and pieced together the route that they had taken. And we later came and tried to walk that route to Wai Chau. Chan Chak himself had written a few articles and Henry Xu also in Chinese. So there were various Chinese papers, documents, very little Japanese, I'm afraid, but I can manage to read Chinese, but not Japanese. Anyway, I never got very far with that, although there was one destroyer that met the MTBs during their journey to Mers Bay, and it did leave some notes about having sighted this escape group.
Japanese destroyer.
And the work, Freddie Guest's book, and one of the MTB captains wrote a book, both which were largely autobiographical. But that was really it. So I came to Hong Kong and China, but otherwise it was pretty much put together in Britain, where really we had an unfair advantage, possibly because the 98% of the escape route was British.
Next question. Steve, please.
Can I just ask you, I mean, you've talked mainly about the cooperation with the KMT. Did any of these British officers also have any dealings with the East River guerrillas, the communist side of it?
Well, the Canadian head of the SOE group, the commando force, Mike Kendall, had worked in China before the war as a mining engineer, and he became involved with British intelligence and
got to know Chinese communist guerrillas behind the lines. So he had actually planned to lead the escape group in conjunction with the East River Column, which was just getting going, which did have links with the with Mao in the north, but was largely made up of just local idealistic youth, you know, vaguely left-wing. But in fact, Chan Chak had better links with the Kuomintang guerrillas, obviously, and in particular with this one group led by Leung Wing-yun, who were basically bandits and smugglers, but they had become fighters against the Japanese also and had helped Chan Chak get weapons and medicine, other supplies, through to Free China. So he led them to this particular bay where this bandit guerrilla group were based. And the East River Column had put into operation a loose route that they hoped to get left-wing Chinese from Hong Kong out after the Japanese took over. And they did help along the way, but it was basically, despite what China now says, it was bandits and vaguely pro-KMT groups rather than pro-Mao Zedong groups.
Another question. In Philip Snow's book, The Fall of Hong Kong, he attributes part of the reason for why the British forces fell so quickly in the new territories to extensive pro-Japanese activities by triads in Kowloon and the southern new territories cutting the British supply lines, and even has a line describing triad attacks, the triad setting up a machine gun nest in the Peninsula Hotel and machine gunning the last star ferries evacuating the British to Hong Kong Island. But Jason Wordy has questioned whether there was a machine gun nest on the Peninsula Hotel. You were mentioned a lot about in your presentation about the problem with fifth columnists. How big a problem were the triads in the initial fall of the British in the new territories in Kowloon? And have you heard anything about that Peninsula Hotel incident? Any of the diaries?
I haven't specifically heard about their machine gun nests in the Peninsula, no. My father-in-law was certainly involved in Kowloon amidst that chaos when there were Japanese agents and Chinese fifth columnists stirring up, rioting as the British made their final withdrawal from Kowloon. But I actually know more about the Hong Kong side where Chan Chak stepped in and really led the teams of triads and sundry other groups who made sure that those that the Japanese had paid off did not succeed in creating the same mayhem on the island as they had in Kowloon.
Okay. Over here, please.
Did you ever come across the name of Arthur May?
In what context?
In the anti-Japanese context, I guess. He was the one who put the British flag up at the end, at the end of the war.
I'm afraid not. In the war itself, the 17-day battle, it's not a name that leaps out, but
actually, maybe you can give the microphone back. Can you tell us a little bit more about him? But just briefly, did he avoid capture throughout the war in Hong Kong? I wasn't aware there was such an individual. Or
well, he was interned by the Japanese, okay. And he manufactured his own radio, and so he got the news of what was going on, and he got the news through. About the atomic bomb, and so he escaped with a friend of his and got down to where his mother's flat was, and in which he'd hidden a Union Jack in a cushion, and he and his friend took this up to the peak and raised it, which had been shown to be advised to be the sign that the war was over.
I think I had heard that, now I come to think of it, yeah. But I mean, there were a lot of escapes after this Chanchak one, along the same route that they had pioneered on Christmas Day, and Alison's father, Colin McEwen, was a member of the British Army Aid Group, which liaised with Chinese guerrillas in forging this escape route until the Japanese finally closed it down, pretty much.
Okay. One of the more vivid passages you described was somebody, was Admiral Chan throwing hand grenades down on somebody signaling from mid-levels. Was that any place we would know here? Do you describe in your book a lot of places that are now known streets and so forth?
There certainly are places which have changed some. I might have one or two more slides if you've got a few minutes.
We've got maybe five more minutes.
Well,
yeah, if that's,
here?
Yeah. This is actually in China. They had a five-day riverboat trip in these boats after the big march. I got problems again. But I don't know the exact place in the mid-levels. These were Chinese soldiers along the route. These are quite rare photos that families had and haven't been seen before. This is Apele Chow as it was then. It's now one of the three most populous places in the world, but it was bare, and the escape party were clambering up these slopes in their underwear after being shot out of their boats and under heavy Japanese fire. This is Telegraph Bay, which is now Cyberport, where we're currently staying with a friend on the 39th floor. And I looked out this morning at the scene, trying to imagine the two motor torpedo boats sitting here on Christmas Day and lying low under their foliage. Changed quite a lot. Right, I think we'll leave it there. This was David McDougall's report to the Colonial Office. This is a magazine that Ted
if they had to escape in. Onto the hills of Apele Chow, how did they get out with the boats later? That's right next to Aberdeen.
There were motor torpedo boats waiting on the other side of Apele Chow, which they picked up. But
okay. Clearly, we all have to read the book. Let's get one or two more questions here. Maybe if I can throw one more in. How was the cooperation between Navy and officers from other service branches? It sounded like they were more of an accidental almost combination of about 50 Navy officers with about 18 non-Navy officers and non-commissioned.
In the escape party,
yes.
It was predominantly Navy. Yeah, there were less than a dozen. Army officers. There was some merchant marine, but it was mainly Royal Navy, and they didn't get on well. No, I think one of the reasons that Hong Kong fell so quickly was that the coordination between the different branches of the armed services was poor. The spirit in the motor torpedo boat flotilla was very good, but they didn't have much chance being constantly bombed from the air. There wasn't all that much they could do. But when they found a lot of army officers being foisted on them, I think there was quite a lot of friction, yes. And that's one of the more interesting parts of the book, I think, how they fared, both officers and ranks and army and navy and Chinese and British.
You mentioned they didn't have any planes after the first day. Was that because they were mostly destroyed on the ground as they were at Pearl Harbor, or were they shot down when they took off to try to defend the colony?
No, they never got into the air. They were the handful of antiquated planes that there were destroyed. in that first air raid on the morning of December the 8th.
Okay, question over here, please.
Peter Bennett. I know Colin McCure, who was friends with my parents back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, came back to Hong Kong. But did anybody else from that party come back? And I know he spent many, many years back in Hong Kong afterwards. What about other people from that escape party?
There were a few. I mean, Sheena's father, David McDougall, headed the post-war civil government. He came back as Brigadier McDougall, but then became Colonial Secretary until he took early retirement in the late 50s. There were various others. Max Oxford became head of civil aviation for a while. Arthur Pittendrick was head of marine police. Henry Hsu was here. Anyone else you can think of? But certainly a little community that carried on. And I think links remained strong. They all tended to remember this as the great experience of greatest adventure of their lives, and their letters are full of very, very warm feelings about Hong Kong and the Chinese. What's amazing, really, is that traveling over China, when there was a reward on their heads, no Chinese villagers ever told the Chinese puppet government or the Japanese themselves anything about them. They were never given away, but were welcomed with buckets of hot rice, hot tea and rice and vegetables wherever they went.
Did the Japanese retaliate against any of those villages later? Did they find out?
Yes, quite a lot of the villages were raised by bombs later. But
because of their helping the escape, or for other reasons?
We think so, yes. Wai Chau itself, the big town, was invaded the week after the escape party left, and particularly brutally, everything was burnt, and they think that was in retaliation for the hospitality they'd been given. Yeah.
Okay, unless we have one more question. We always like to give our guests something to remember the club by, and particularly somebody like Tim, who had 23 years of the BBC. We know you can always use another FCC garment, so here. Thank you very much for coming to the club.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming. We hope we'll see you at more of our club lunches, and the book is on sale at the entrance if you'd like to buy a copy and have Tim sign it now. He's staying afterwards and signing it, and particularly if